this is our third session. It's May 8, 2006. We're just finishing up describing the cover of the book and the first epigraph, I guess you'd call it. We're going to get into the text in a few minutes. I just want to say I ended off the last session defining the title, Phatic Communion, and I began by explaining the term phatic communication. The tape went out, but I was going to say that if you look up the word phatic, P-H-A-T-I-C, in the dictionary, a good dictionary, it will define it as general sociability, expressions of general amiability. It's like saying hello and waving at someone. That's the broadest dictionary definition of phatic, as opposed to how Malinowski meant it and how Jakobson meant it. I always use the example of an example of a phatic exchange is when you're interacting with someone at work and they say, how are you doing? And you say, okay, how are you doing? And the person doesn't tell you how they're doing, and you didn't tell the initiator of the exchange how you were doing. It's just a way of, so you're not taking the question literally and answering it. You're saying that the question is an acknowledgement to you, it's an acknowledgement, a gesture towards you, and not to be interpreted literally. So that kind of waving at each other and acknowledging is an example of a statement where the medium is the meaning, not the content. The content of the sentence is not what's to be addressed. It's the function of the expression, how are you doing, that's to be addressed, or the form of it, or its purpose. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So then I came up with phatic communion, which is, I think, I have to actually go back and check Malinowski to see if he may have coined the phrase phatic communion in his essay, the appendix to the book, The Meaning of Meaning, may be phatic communion. But in linguistics, taking over the phatic function, they called it a type of communication. So maybe that's where I'm not remembering that Malinowski actually used the term phatic communion, because I first discovered the term in McLuhan's writing. And I think he uses phatic communion at one point and phatic communication at another point. But anyway, phatic communion, for a Catholic like McLuhan, resonates with the famous Catholic communion service, right?
Mm-hmm.
That when you attend a Mass, you engage communion, I think. Isn't that what they call it?
I think so.
Yeah. So you engage with the communion. So phatic communion, for me, is a pun on the word Vatic, V-A-T-I-C. I'm explaining how I mean it. Not only just as phatic communication and interaction between the four featured scholars and myself. There's a phatic interplay by them with me, and also there's the pun on Vatic, V-A-T-I-C, and Vatic refers, is defined as prophetic communication, someone who's Vatic. Probably the word Vatican came from that, or vice versa. So I think the word Vatican comes from Vates, V-A-T-E-S, Latin, I guess, which means seers or prophets, I think. It's been a while since I thought about this. But in my own use of phatic, I'm saying that there's phatic communion with Bob Dobbs, and I'm communing with prophets. So there's the pun on phatic and Vatic, V-I-T-I-C. But what's interesting is that these prophets, largely writers and verbal prophets, are reduced to mere waving and interaction, a phatic interaction, within the environment of the Android meme. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm symbolic of the Android meme in the book, and therefore these great thinkers and literate producers are reduced to a phatic relationship with me. Another meaning of phatic communion can be, in McLuhan's terms, how he defines as tactility. Tactility is not a sense, but the interplay of senses. If you imagine there is this function that is tactility, and it's coordinating the data from different senses, it has to have a phatic relationship with each sensory input. Can't identify with or emphasize one or the other to create the interplay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tactility for me is code for the phatic function, or an understanding of the tactile function can be understood as I've defined the phatic function.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, you think of the image of God, or the Christian God, say. He's an entity, he or she is an entity. Well, in the Christian patriarchal tradition, it's a he. He's an entity that recognizes everybody equally and is sociable with everybody, concerned about everybody. That, to me, is a huge capital P phatic function. God is a phatic being, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's just amiable with everybody. Everybody is equally of concern to him, and he's looking out for every one of us. And he's passing through, and we pray to him, and he waves back. You know, it's saying, what does God say to us? Everything's on course, no problem, straight ahead, right?
Right.
Which is like a phatic statement. So communion in terms of a religious function, a religious ritual, there's the religious level in here too. So phatic or vatic, communion or communication, it's a sacred ritual. As it has on the back of the Bosmian Ecology album, is this a souverain? It's a souvenir from a ritual in progress. So interacting with this book is a ritual. It's a new form of prayer, a new form of meditation, a new form of media yoga. So this is the first text for media yoga. All right?
All right. Yeah.
Inaugural text for media yoga. At least for the eye and the ear. Or if you're holding it, it's tactile, but it's largely a left hemisphere interaction, this medium.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to refer to the non-literary with my part of the book,
right,
which consists of transcripts of radio. So it's evoking another medium, right?
Right. I just Googled phatic communion, and just to sort of reiterate or possibly amplify a little bit on what you just said, came up with a web page. It says levels of communication, a cheat sheet, NANPEC, Northern Virginia Communication College. And he defines phatic communion using conventional messages to establish rapport, to break the ice, and or end a conversation. You might hug, kiss, shake hands, bow, smile, make eye contact, and face one another. We exchange pleasantries using cliches. Cliches are overused expressions that have lost their original content or meaning, and have taken on new relational meanings. We expect phatic communion at the beginning and end of every conversation, regardless of our feelings about a person. Examples: hello, how are you? I'm fine, how are you? Hi, plastic or paper? Thanks for coming. Have a nice day. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's good, because it reminds me of the phatic function as it's defined there, is the transformative function, or the gap. It's moving across the gap before you encounter the person, and then you encounter them. You need this phatic level established in the metamorphosis, in the transformation, into a direct interaction with a little more purpose, maybe. And then you leave that interaction and go back into the gap, and the means to do that is the phatic function.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely a tactile. The tactility is in the gap. So he's expressing and helping understand what I meant by phatic as a tactile function, and that is a gap function. The gap before the beginning and the gap after the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like McLuhan used to say that they always had a light news, back in the 60s, they always had a light news item at the end of the news broadcast as a way of dismissing people, you know, lighten it up. Like a humor story. So even the news broadcast ended on a phatic level.
Right, and that's the way it is.
Yeah. The last item. It's often a silly item or a trivial item.
Uh-huh.
That's the way it was back in the 50s, 60s. I don't watch the news anymore. I don't know what they do now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there is news anymore. It's just one ongoing phatic interaction. They probably don't. It's constantly dismissed and dismissing the news.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then that could get us into your interpretation of looking at Jon Stewart's Daily Show. That's popular because it's dismissing all the news by translating into irony and humor and not necessarily triviality, but into another level of moving it beyond the emphatic to the phatic. So that proves my point. The emphatic news broadcast has ended a long time ago, and the phatic function of news is being highlighted and taken over the whole program, and that's represented by people getting news from the Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to look at that for now. Maybe there's more ways to look at that Jon Stewart function.
Okay.
So when you say you don't watch the news anymore, you watch Jon Stewart. When you say what you're dropping is emphatic news, news that's talking to you completely. But as we've moved into the Android meme reality over the last 30 years, people realize the media isn't talking to them. And that's a pretty devastating apocalyptic realization. So the world has already ended in terms of communication, and now we're just standing on the rubble and engaging in non-emphatic communication, which is phatic.
Right. I don't know that people realize that, you know, in their individual level.
They don't realize that. I would be considered schizophrenic. All kinds of different slanderous terms, libelous terms we've thrown at me, is failing to understand why people are doing it. But that's because most people are somnambulist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty frightening to be in a post-communication world. And so let's keep talking. It's like whistling in the dark. Daily news is whistling in the dark, you know, like we're in a post-communication world. And that's very terrifying. There's no... Because language was a form of sharing and comforting, engaging. The phatic function is a very important function. You're acknowledging there's someone else besides yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the community function. And this is what Malinowski discovered, is that the phatic, not the emphatic. You know, literate people want emphatic communication.
Right.
But they forgot the phatic function, and Malinowski discovered the phatic function still alive in these primitive tribes. And that was the original function of communication, which
yeah.
maybe is a sharing without too much pointedness.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember John Lilly once said that he didn't really want to engage all that much in phatic communion. He didn't use that term, and I may be not...
The term is pull-down term... The put-down term is that's a lot of small talk.
He sort of distinguished between sort of small talk or phatic communion and then language as communicating directives, communicating some specific information that had practical application, which
yeah.
was what he was interested in communicating.
And that's the literate person. That's the literate bias.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what communication was for, let's say, in the 18th, 19th century. But once you get into the radio environment and the overload of information 100 years ago, 75 years ago, the emphatic function lost its hegemony, its dominance.
Mm-hmm.
And the phatic took over. And that's why Duchamp and Joyce really got a lot out of the book, The Meaning of Meaning. They really really learned something from it. And they were able to handle the new information environment and move out of 19th century ideas of literature and art and make, you know, amazing new art because they explored the phatic, having read Malinowski's appendix to The Meaning of Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the authors of The Meaning of Meaning, Ogden and Richards, they were the ones, I think it was mainly Ogden, who taped Joyce. We have Joyce reading excerpts from his books and Finnegan's Wake, and they were taped by Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a close relationship with them after the book came out. So it's the discovery of the phatic function that's very important for radical modernism and avant-garde, great avant-garde artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so small talk took over, the elephantiasis of small talk, because it was very hard to deal with the overwhelming information. If you took all information as meaning as something that had to be dealt with and emphatically realized and organized and responded to, you couldn't do that once you had the radio environment.
Right. And just to bring in another level real quick, all language is metaphor. And I remember one time you said that McLuhan once defined himself as a professor of metaphor.
Yeah. But what do we mean by metaphor? All language is metaphor. Do you know what how McLuhan defined metaphor?
Probably not.
Yeah. He defined, you know, in all his books he would bring back and remind you of his definition of metaphor or what metaphor really came from. It meant to bridge across. It meant traversing the gap.
Mm-hmm.
So the metaphor, the word metaphor meant something that bridged the gap, but changed the meaning as it bridged the gap. And he said, just as bridges, you build a bridge in a community, it changes the community. It's a new technology. It changes the relationships of the area around what was bridged. So metaphors are not abstract signs. They're active processes. And they are the essence of communication. They're in the gap. They're translating. So it's a translating, transforming function is what he means by metaphor.
Yeah.
You talk to most literate people, they say, well, this is a metaphor. They, in their mind, think of an image. They think metaphor is just a static image, a resting image, like the Christian cross, what you pray to. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
That's a literate form of metaphor. But
right.
metaphor itself looks at all forms of expression and sees that they are active dramatic processes. So McLuhan brought the dramatic function, retrieved the dramatic meaning of metaphor to the 20th century via poets like Pound, Joyce, Lewis, and Eliot, and Yeats, who retrieved the phatic, the metaphoric function of language, the active processing of language,
mm-hmm.
as a counter to the rigidification of language by science,
mm-hmm.
which was the literate effect.
Right.
So John Lilly is emphasizing the literate left hemisphere function of language.
Right. So McLuhan had a meaning distinct from, say, the nominalists who had their own.
Yeah, that's what his thesis was about, was the nominalist dominance of the meaning of metaphor since Newton, and before Newton it was a grammatical rhetorical meaning of metaphor, and that was retrieved in the 20th century by what people call the radical modernists, Pound, Eliot, Joyce, and Lewis, and others. That's why McLuhan ends his thesis, which is about a 16th century person at the time of Shakespeare, Thomas Nash. It goes back to Greek times, you know, 500 B.C., moves up to 1600, and ends. That's the thesis ends. It's the history of the trivium. And he, in his last line of his thesis, which you can just get today, in May 2006, it's now available to be bought for the first time in ever, put up by Ginkgo Press. Anyways, and Ginkgo is G-I-N-G-K-O, I think. That's how you spell it. He ends his last line to the thesis on a 16th century writer and pamphleteer, Thomas Nash. He says, and the person who made us understand what several hundred years, 18th, 19th century scholarship under the nominalist and the dialectical tradition failed and lost was amnesiac about. Joyce, he says, was the one who taught us how to see what actual communication style was being done by Nash and his contemporaries, that which style had been forgotten. So in his last line, in the early 40s, he's saying James Joyce is the key to understanding his thesis, his PhD thesis, and what was going on with Nash and others. And Joyce retrieved the dynamic function of metaphor. I mean, McLuhan would say that Portrait of the Artist was a lyric expression, the first novel by Joyce. Then the next major one is Ulysses, and that's an epic novel. And then Finnegans Wake is not lyric or epic, but dramatic. And dramatic is showing the process, and that's using metaphor as a dynamic bridge. All right?
All right.
So, we did that. You wanted to do metaphor, so we've done that, right?
Right.
So, all these themes we'll be coming back to, but we've laid it out basically two sessions. Now we're beginning the third, and we're now going to start to read the book.
Yes, and we dip our big toe into the waters of Phatic Communion by Bob Dobbs on page 4.
Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs.
With Bob Dobbs. And
that's what the title is.
Okay. We begin with some text excerpted from Lyndon LaRouche's Beyond Psychoanalysis, published in The Campaigner, September, October 1973.
Right, and this is page 4.
Page 4.
Right, because page 3 had the epigraph, and we had the poem, the excerpt from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and the page 2 was the publisher credit, and page 1 was just the title of the book with the logo, which we all discussed. Yes. All right, so Scott's going to start reading, and when I feel like it, I'll comment on it or wait for Scott's questions.
Okay.
So the first word is
humanism. As a practical way of describing such notions of freedom and necessity,
I would say, Scott, you got to read it really carefully, because it could have sounded like you're saying humanism is. You got to say humanism, maybe even comma, as a practical. Let's just really articulate it clearly so people hear it right.
Okay.
Humanism. Start off with the word humanism, which is the first word in the book.
Yeah. We'll see how this plays out. I'm not a great reader, but just go ahead and jump in grammatically wherever you want to.
Just enunciate.
Yeah.
Well.
Okay. So humanism, as a practical way of describing such notions of freedom / necessity, begins with attention to the creative individual whose inventions make general progress possible. Freedom means, initially, the conditions favorable to the discovery and propagation of new fundamental laws, new ways of doing things by individuals. Humanism is therefore also occupied with the conditions required to produce such gifted individuals, the material and political conditions necessary to produce the numbers and varieties of gifted individuals society requires for maintaining the necessary rate of general progress. As a corollary, humanism is also occupied with the material and political conditions of the population more generally, its mobility, cultural development, and material preconditions of cultural development. And then in italicized, it says, that new inventions might be realized for practice by a general society culturally qualified to assimilate the conceptions involved in such practice.
So that's an essay beyond
psychoanalysis.
Beyond psychoanalysis, written in LaRouche's political magazine in New York City in the early 70s when he was running the, National Labor Committee, as they were called? Yeah, the NL, the National Labor Committee, something like that. Anyways, it was an outgrowth of the SDS radical people that he was involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not running for president yet, but he's putting out this scholarly journal called The Campaigner. So this is from an essay, 1973, Beyond Psychoanalysis.
Right.
So you have any comment on it?
Not so far.
Yeah.
Well, I'm familiar with LaRouche, so it makes sense to me.
Yeah, it really.
It'll make more sense as to someone unfamiliar with LaRouche as we continue.
Yes. And now, what's interesting is this is a perfect quote to begin with, because LaRouche is the representative of technological liberalism, and this is a perfect definition of the services of technology, of technological growth. And it is what's called the humanist mandate, and humanism comes in at the beginning of the printing press, generally, historically. The humanists were the thinkers who were succeeding the feudal Catholic-dominated Europe. So they wanted to develop science, develop a secular form of education that was not controlled by the semi-Luddite tendencies of the church. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So humanism is a European impetus, a European invention. And it is the founding word for what later is called technological liberalism in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So why I picked this quote was, he is putting all his cards into, and his bets, into the role of progress, general progress. And we know in the 20th century that technological progress, after World War II and the atomic bomb, started to look not so rosy as it had been in the 19th and first half of the 20th century. The disservices of technology were starting to surface and darken and make it harder to convince people that technology was progress. But LaRouche had a whole theory and view that there was actual propaganda being put out by certain oligarchic intelligence agencies to stop the growth of progress and technological progress so that they could lock down a new world order, which would actually just preserve the old world order, of the first half of the 20th century. It's the 1984 world that Orwell predicted happening in the 1945, 1950, 55 period.
Right. And LaRouche sees this automated control of Big Brother as being a positive step that we have to dive into as opposed to something we have to be afraid and run away from.
I would say that the automated, and he writes about, he first became the kind of thinker he became when he heard about Norbert Wiener and what his theory of cybernetics was in the management of society, and LaRouche objected to that. He thought that moving into an automated computerized environment was a big disservice in preventing the development of new necessary technological breakthroughs. So he was not for the automated society.
Okay.
He's criticized since the 70s the post-industrial society, which is another word for the computerized dominant society.
Mm-hmm.
The information highway society.
Mm.
So he wanted hardware development. He wanted new forms of energy. He wanted to spread the nuclear reactor plants all over the planet because he thought that was the best way to make energy to feed and house what he demanded, more people.
Mm-hmm.
But the disservice, for at least presented in the media, whether that was controlled or not, by 1960, people are beginning to think, well, maybe we got population explosion here. We got too many people. Maybe we can't feed them. Maybe we should not develop so vigorously new forms of energy since nuclear plants are looming over us and may lead to pollution and atomic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole bad press that technological progress, as it was by the mid-20th century, that was seen to be starting to dominate, LaRouche put at the foot of Bertrand Russell and British oligarchs. Bertrand Russell was trying to ban the bomb and have people stop nuclear technology spreading. LaRouche said that was Malthusian. He objected to that, and he thought it came from an insidious group of people that were trying to get us back to the Dark Ages again.
Mm. So when you made an association with George Orwell, were you saying that LaRouche was reacting against that idea, or that he didn't see that as being a real threat?
Well, I don't know if you've read LaRouche on Orwell, but LaRouche said Orwell was a British intelligence agent.
Wow.
And laid out a dark scenario for the second half of the 20th century as a propagandist spreading cultural pessimism and helping the Bertrand Russell gang of European oligarchs.
Mm.
So the negative view that 1984 projected, which was based on either 1948 or the 30s, that dark image LaRouche felt was creating cultural pessimism. So he wanted to counter that negative projection for the second half of the 20th century and say there's lots of great things that we can make,
mm-hmm.
that we can do and develop if we train people with cultural optimism,
mm-hmm.
and not stress the disservices of technology as they were perceived in the mid-20th century. But what's interesting about this quote is he's praising technology, and he's also discussing how do you make people smart enough, how do you train students and young people, how do you make them gifted enough to keep developing technology, which LaRouche felt was necessary to keep the standard of living you were at.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't just ride along at what you achieved. You needed to develop and to make better technology just to maintain where you were and also develop new levels.
Mm-hmm.
But to maintain where you were, he claimed, you had to develop more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
on what he called essential technological development, basic, big paradigm-shifting developments in energy and that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now this is a this book is a souvenir from my radio broadcast, which was describing the Android meme of the 80s, though I didn't use that term. The term that people used back then was virtual reality. But it's the idea that technology had come alive and was taking on a life of its own. And you'll notice that I pick these four people, LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, because they emphasize technology. And one could, if you stood back, say that they are propagandists for the Android meme because they're emphasizing technology so much. They're not emphasizing the humanist, cultural arts, so to speak. Because it was C.P. Snow who wrote the book, The Two Cultures, which was about the lack of dialogue between the arts and the sciences. So I'm taking four people who are not afraid to deal with the sciences and are supposed artists and humanists themselves, but they don't shrink from technology. And LaRouche, he is using the word humanism, which for many people was just the arts, painting, music, literature, theater, opera, and he's taking that reference point and emphasizing how important technology is. Now, that would be the view of technocrats after World War II, anyways, at MIT and that. This is what people back in the 50s, 60s started to complain about, the humanists, the artists, the people in the humanities. They complained that the technocrats were taking over education. But LaRouche didn't... This is where... That is the technological liberalism taking over after World War II. But LaRouche dances on their toes and says they're doing it all wrong. He's not reacting like a Luddite or a humanist who says we should stop developing technology. I mean, it's just not leading anywhere. It's healthy. LaRouche says, no, we've got to deal with technology, but we'll direct it differently. So you see what I mean? He's working within the MIT paradigm, but saying they're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look differently at technology. And mm-hmm. that way we can develop the talented people that would meet the demands for more and more science and more solving of technological issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting, I did an Evergreen session with Norbert Wiener back about 2000. Norbert Wiener and some of those people at MIT after World War II, and they spoke to us, if you believe it was them.
Norbert Wiener was the father of
cybernetics. Yeah, and the sort of the takeover, the beginning of the computer. And on my chart is 1918 to 1945, so that starts to become a guaranteed environment after World War II, and it's being modulated. It's the new environment, parallel with television and the coming satellite environment. And Norbert Wiener and them discussed after World War II, because you get all these GIs coming back and starting families, how are they going to educate their kids inside, what kind of school system are you going to develop inside of the Cold War? So Norbert Wiener's spirit told us that one of the main discussions was how to create a genius. So it's very interesting that that is a big theme in LaRouche. He's saying in this first paragraph, what are the conditions that allows gifted individuals, or even to create potential gifted individuals, to flourish? So that is the question from the technological liberalist point of view. So, and just humanism, its word itself, as you get into my stuff, you'll see that, you know, humanity's disappeared and the kind of things that I would say. So we're beginning with humanism, or just human beings, as one of its resonant echoes and meanings. Human beings, as a practical way of describing such notions of freedom and necessity, begins with attention to the creative individual. Humans pay attention to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But they're moving into a world that's increasingly, under Android meme conditions, not going to pay attention to people. It seemingly not paying attention to them.
Which LaRouche isn't necessarily aware of that point.
No.
About the Android meme.
No, that's Dobstock.
A theme... which will become more apparent as we go along, and which you just touched on, was that his political platform is largely sort of a rebellion to this British intelligence
there's some acronyms, I don't remember, like MI5 or MI6 or something like that.
Yeah. And what about them?
That I'm just pointing out that a driving force in his theology is rebellion against, pointing out the disservices of this British intelligence influence.
Managers. He's pointing out, he knows that a world government has been established, at least after World War II, but it was prepared for through World War I. And in between World War I and World War II was the Institute, British Institute Tavistock, which laid the groundwork for propaganda in the World War II, and laid the groundwork for the managing of the global village of the 40s and 50s after World War II. And it's the Anglo-American establishment, he said. Basically, they, under America, won the war, so they can manage the global village. So he's up against their notions of management.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks that they betrayed FDR. Roosevelt's mandate, and Truman fell under the sway of Bertrand Russell and those people that weren't keen on technological progress. They, from Luther's point of view, wanted to turn the global village into a feudal situation, a modern update of the feudal structure where people were techno-serfs.
Mm-hmm.
So this statement by LaRouche is a pretty articulate statement. When you understand it, this guy is no fool. He can think,
yeah,
and he can spell out something. This is not a guy who's a loony conspiracy theorist who's claiming the Queen is pushing drugs. You know, the image that the Android Bee makes of him.
That's not. Well, he did. Didn't he? Did he publish Dope Inc.?
Yes. Yes.
So, and isn't that what that was about? The Queen pushing dope.
What he was saying was British intelligence was irresponsible, and their figurehead of the wealth that the British intelligence managed and operated from, the figurehead for that was the Queen. And he said the Queen and British intelligence were irresponsible in allowing the dope flows to happen around the planet for economic profit motives.
Yeah.
And for managing the global village.
Right.
He thought that the dope market should be managed differently.
Right.
So when he says the Queen pushes dope, if he ever said that, maybe his newspaper did that as a headline, but that was within the newspaper world.
Right.
We're reading LaRouche from his essay world,
mm-hmm.
not the newspaper world. But when you're communicating on the street with headlines, you attract people's attention with the Queen pushes drugs. And he's saying that everybody in the global village is interconnected, and if you have an irresponsible attitude to the mafia-ridden dope market and the laundering of money through major banks, then you're, in effect, pushing drugs, in quotes.
Yeah. Well, I think Mao's revolution was a reaction to the opium trade, which was funded by the British.
Yeah, and the Europeans, the Americans, and a lot of the establishment families of New England 300 years ago made their money in the dope business.
Mm-hmm.
So the Anglo-American establishment was involved always with drug traffic. Back in the 18th, 19th century, it was part of warfare. You know, you drugged the Chinese to subdue them and take over their territory.
Right.
So, but what's interesting is that to say the Queen is pushing drugs is a on-the-street, in-your-face statement of a media ecologist, but a media ecologist in the technological liberalism school.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
He's demanding a remanaging of techno-structures, and part of those techno-structures is the drug market. All right?
All right.
So, the italicized last sentence, I just read the last sentence of that paragraph you read. As a corollary, humanism is also occupied with the material and political conditions of the population. Note that, material and political, more generally. It's looking at humanism is not a specialist writing analyses of poems or of music or theater reviews. What we see is a literate university, almost monkish kind of existence of academic life. He felt that the academic should be more involved in the political realities and the management problems that intelligence agencies brought in after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So as a corollary, humanism is also occupied with the material and political conditions of the population more generally, concerned about its mobility, cultural development, and material preconditions of cultural development. You've got to keep expanding technological comforts and enhancements to get a ongoing, non-entropic, negentropic is the word,
expansion of cultural development necessary to maintain where you are at this point.
Right.
Then he says, what he means by that is that new inventions might be realized for practice by a general society culturally qualified to assimilate the conceptions involved in such practice. The citizens more and more have to understand the notions and ideas that built the technological structure they live in, and they have to master that so that they can develop new stuff.
Right.
And the first quote.
And he believed in accelerating population density because it's like only so many geniuses are born out of so many births, and if you accelerate population density, you accelerate the rate at which geniuses are born who can then solve the problems, technological problems that we're creating along the way.
Yeah, and that is the humanist dogma, that the citizen has to be educated to have a viable nation. And so he's saying we're going to have more and more complex demands as we get better and better technology. We're going to need better and better technology to maintain that initial level of great technology that's coming down the pike. And therefore, we need more and more people who are on the genius level, at least a genius compared, say, 40 years ago. What would be a genius 40 years ago must become standard in the population. So it's not just like throwing the dice and having more people so you can get a few more geniuses. You need way beyond that kind of attitude. You've got to develop geniuses more and more throughout society. And in general, you look back, you know, people are geniuses compared to people 100 years ago just naturally because the media, because the technology acquainted them with new complexities.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, society doesn't have to learn to drive a bike now. They need to drive. The citizen needs to know how to drive television, cars, subways, and recreational means.
Right, but now we're starting to seep into the McLuhan perspective in terms
yep.
of yeah.
Now, do you want? Let's continue with this page four. Well, for those who don't know, page five is McLuhan quotes.
Right. Yeah.
But let's finish page four first.
Yeah. There's. Two more paragraphs on page four, a sentence at the bottom. I thought rather than just, and the sentence at the bottom is truncated, so I figured I'll just complete page four. The bottom sentence overlaps onto page five, finish that paragraph, and then
goes over to six.
Six, yeah. And
yeah,
then we'll come back to page five.
Right. Okay, so here we are, the second paragraph.
Yeah.
And it's in italics, the first sentence. This is from the same essay.
Yeah.
Beyond Psychoanalysis.
Right. The evolution of man is absolutely contrasted to the existence and behavior of any of the lower beasts, chimpanzees included. In the lower beasts, including the higher apes, virtually no alteration in the range of behavior occurs progressively from generation to generation. The per capita caloric throughput and rates of potential growth of that species of biomass material are essentially fixed, at least in range. With man, the physiology of creative mentation, exhibited in more rudimentary fashion by Kohler's chimpanzees, has led to deliberatively synthesized new technologies, equivalent in effect to a species' negentropic values. Oh, I skipped a sentence.
Equivalent in effect to a species'
deliberately turning itself by will into a higher species with higher negentropic values. It is indeed man's study of his own progress through such processes of deliberation which makes possible and is scientific knowledge.
Yeah, now, Steve, you have any, you can comment on this, but what strikes you about this sentence?
Well, he is comparing and contrasting human beings to all other animals, including the animals with higher intelligence, chimpanzees, and so on. Did you say that LaRouche was allied himself with Catholic spiritual ideals? What's his religious affiliation?
Well, what's interesting is that most people think religion, like in C.P. Snow's book, The Two Cultures, The Arts versus the Sciences, most people don't think of religion as scientific or involved with the technological enterprise. But that's what's unique about LaRouche. He says the basic Christian theology was aligned with technological growth, which is dancing on the toes of normal religious cliches. I mean, back then in the 60s when he was saying this, early 70s, I don't think people thought that Christ was all for developing nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm.
Or that whole technological liberalist enterprise. I don't think people saw that Christ or the Buddha were involved with that. But LaRouche is saying in his essays that that is the mandate of a true understanding of Jesus Christ, that he believed this was the best of all possible worlds. And LaRouche, now we're getting to another interesting aspect, since these people are all within the Android meme on my chart, LaRouche is identifying with technology and making it part of the Christian mandate. That's unique. But
yeah.
One could say he's a dupe of the Android meme, which is making everybody think technology and the Android meme is where it's at, becoming cyber.
Yeah, but he's still emphasizing developing reason within the human individual. I mean,
he prizes
the human individual above all else.
Right, and so that is why it sounds religious. And so definitely he always supported John Paul VI's manifesto. I can't remember what it was. He cited the Pope back in the 1890s that had an important manifesto. What do they call those proclamations? Forget the term. The papal bull. The papal bull, he would always quote major papal bulls as saying the Pope agrees with LaRouche's interpretation of our mandate and that the Pope is an important ally against the British Protestant religion.
Is that his projection, or do you believe that's true about the Pope?
Well, his words say that, but that's more recent popes. I don't know if that was what a pope, definitely popes 100 years ago.